One of the most important things is any community such as this, or in your office or at home, is that sometimes we get what we want, sometimes we don't get what we want. And sometimes I always think, when we don't get what we want, that's even better. Because what it's teaching us is that the world is out of control. In other words, out of your control. Because we always want to get it our way. And sometimes it doesn't work. All those people who wanted to have lots of questions this evening, you're going to not get the opportunity. And you think, this is unfair. Why did this happen to me? What can we do to make sure it doesn't happen again? And those of you who wanted to talk, you think, great, another good talk, this is wonderful. But you're the guys, the second group, who loses out, because in the spiritual path, one of the greatest things to have happen to you is disappointment, frustration, not getting your own way. Because what that leads to is you don't try to get your own way so much in the future. You don't try to control things. You actually can let things go more and just flow with things. Coming back to stories of my own life so far, one of the wonderful experiences I had here in Serpentine in Western Australia, building our monastery, was when we decided to plan our meditation hall. All of those of you who've been up to Serpentine, a Bodhinyana monastery, who've seen our meditation hall, were not just where we give talks, we meditate, we do ordinations and stuff, but when we were designing it, I had a big argument with the other monk there at the time, who was the abbot then, I was number two, with Ajahn Jakava, because he wanted to build it one way, I wanted to build it another way, and you know, I was right. I'd done lots of buildings. He hadn't done any buildings. I knew how buildings worked. He didn't. And so when he had his design, I said, that's a stupid design. It won't work. And it's much better to have it another way. It'll be cheaper, be bigger, be cooler, have more meditation. So he had this big argument for about 1 week. And I would put all the arguments for my design. He would take them back. And he would refute them and put all his arguments for his design. I was being very silly. Actually, so was he, but nevertheless. But it just occurred to me just one day, just to think, what am I doing this for? I'm a monk. Monks shouldn't have arguments. There must be another way of dealing with this problem. We just were acting almost like husband and wife, having arguments like that, who's going to do it this way and what do it that way. So in one moment of inspiration, remembering I was a monk and what a Buddhist should actually do, I took a tray of candles, incense and flowers to his hut to ask forgiveness. Now even though I'd done nothing wrong, even though I still to this day think my design was much better, that was not the point. I was going to exploit this for my own personal advantage. That was not my intention, I was just trying to be inspired. So I asked forgiveness. So I was sorry for arguing for these few days. And I remember Ajahn Jakava being quite taken aback. So, wow, it's an amazing thing to do because, you know, usually in life people argue and no one gives in. But I decided to give in. And I said afterwards, because he was quite sort of grateful that I was giving in, and I said, now I want to ask for a favour. And of course, whenever people ask for a favour, very suspicious, what is it? And I said, I already said, I want to agree with you to build a hall your way. But my favour is this, can I be the builder? Can I be the one who organises all this and even actually works hard on that building? I want to be the builder of this building I don't agree with. And of course, he agreed. And if you look at the building license of the main hall at Bodhinyana Monastery, it's got Ajahn Brahm's name on it. I was a builder. And I worked so hard on that building. But I always did it his way and his design. And that was a wonderful training for me because I said, I'm going to do something I don't like to do. I'm going to do something even which I think could be done better. And why? Not because a hall is important, because the spiritual development of a human being is more important. Who cares about halls? Hall can be this way or that way, but what's really important is people and your spiritual development. And so growing as a human being who realize you don't control your environment, but you can still make something out of it. And so for 2 years we worked on that building. And of course, you know, just I'm not a professional builder. You know, sometimes what some people saw me do, sometimes they were terrified. I remember just all the scaffold we had to build up. And of course, the monks did all that scaffold work. And when you got to the very top there, the bricklayer refused to go up. Because, you know, it was shaking this way and that way and this way and that way. But we managed to coax him to go up there. And you could have seen some of the last bricks, especially on the big corners of the top. I laid those bricks myself because no one else would go up there. And there was no scaffold at that right at the very top. You just had to crawl on the edges. This wall which had no support this way or that way, the very peak, I crawled up there carefully with a bucket of cement in one hand and a brick in the other and laying them. And my goodness, some people who saw me thought that you must have some levitational powers, you didn't fall off because you had nothing to actually to hold on to. But I did that, and of course a few times you did sort of cut yourself and bruise yourself. And so I know that to many traditional Buddhists, they're very proud of the fact that in the spread of Buddhism throughout the whole world through many centuries, it's never been spread through the sword or through violence. No blood has ever been shed, they say, to make Buddhism grow in this world. And of course I say, that is wrong. I shed my blood many times on those buildings. Every building in that monastery has got my DNA on it. Because, you know, you would hit your finger with the hammer, you cut it on the steel roof sheeting or whatever else. So I actually gave so much to that building. And when it was finished, I thought, wow, I can actually contribute 100% to something I think should be done better. And what that was for me was actually learning how to let go. But not just to let go and say, I disagree, I'm not going to help you anymore, it's all up to you. No, but not agreeing, understanding that's part of life. You never get agreements between two people, three people, four people. But nevertheless, even though we don't agree, we can still work together. And I wanted to prove that that was possible. So whenever you have a vote like this and you're on the losing side, actually you're the one who has the advantage. The advantage actually to use any disappointment or any way of not getting your own way as a path of training yourself to not always have to get your own way. Otherwise, how can you ever live with another person? Actually, how can you live with yourself? You know, sometimes I come up here in the evening, I think, I'm going to give a really good talk tonight, and I give a stupid talk. Sometimes you really try hard to do something good, and it doesn't work out properly. And I found out you just can't control this world. All you can ever do is to try your very best and have a sincere heart, put forth your energy and kindness as much as possible. Most times it works, but sometimes it won't. And when it doesn't work, what happens? If you're the person who, when it doesn't work, doesn't know how to deal with when things don't turn out the way you wanted it to, then what most people do, they get frustrated. They get frustrated. Why can't this other person see that I'm in the right? You know what the other person's thinking? Why can't she see that I'm in the right? So you get frustrated, first of all. And I've noticed the next stage after frustration, and I think you've all experienced frustration of not getting it your own way, when things don't work out the way they should do, when there's so many obstacles in front of what you know is a good thing to do. After you get frustrated, what happens next? Anger. People start getting so upset. You stupid monk, you stupid wife, you stupid husband. And that anger is such a painful thing for both parties to experience. That's why getting angry at this other monk who I really respected and cared for, I felt terrible about myself for getting angry, and it was just a rotten thing to actually to do. It was painful for everybody, and I was really embarrassed about it. So why do people get angry at each other? You don't have to. It's only because you get frustrated, because you think you can control everything and get your own way. So remember, what's really more important, this is one of the insights I had from that experience, it was more important for me to not get angry than get things done right. And to this day, I always try and encourage my monks, encourage Buddhist society members and the committee, it's more important not that you get things done, but the way you get things done. The running of this centre doesn't have to be the most perfect centre, the best building, the best kept grounds, clean and tidy, because you shout at people and get angry at them. I'd rather have a messy monastery, a filthy Buddhist centre, with everything falling apart, as long as the people aren't falling apart, as the people are kind to each other, as the people try and work together in harmony together. Because maybe as a monk, my priorities are different. The success of any community is not material. It's the spiritual part of it. And I've seen many people sacrifice the spiritual heart just to get the big temple or the big church or the big sort of fundraiser to buy big things. And it kills people. I remember as a young man going to this Buddhist temple in East London, and I was just a young man from maybe about a few years as a monk, and I was visiting my mother in London. I wanted to get some books, and so there was very few bookshops sold Buddhist books, but there was a temple in the east of London, and I went there. They converted a fire station. It looked really good. And I told him, wow, it's a wonderful job you've done here. Converting this fire station looks a great Buddhist temple. And he said, yeah, but the amount of blood which had to flow in our members, there was just so much anger and so much ill will in building it this way. So everybody wanted to do it their way. And I realized that I'd rather have a temple which didn't look so good, which had happy people. And that was more important, because we're building Buddhism, kindness, love, not things. And I don't know how long ago I told this story, but it's one of my favorite little stories and anecdotes. I tell it overseas a lot, but it gives you an idea of what I'm talking about here, about, you know, the spiritual, about the way we do things is more important than what we do. And that was the story of, it was in the newspapers at the time, and it was a big scandal, front page in all the newspapers many years ago, when an American soldier in Guantanamo Bay had been accused of taking a copy of the Quran and flushing it down the toilet. And the Muslims throughout the world were complaining, making threats of retaliation, protesting along the streets. And it was such big news that here in Perth, the journalist from the West Australian called me up. And he said, I'm doing an article on this, and I've been calling up all the religious leaders in Perth, asking them the same question. He asked the Archbishop, the Anglican, I think it was Peter Carnley at the time, if someone took a copy of the Bible and flushed it down your toilet, what would your reaction be? And he said, I'm now asking you, as a Buddhist monk, Ajahn Brahm, as a leader, if someone took a Buddhist holy book and flushed it down your toilet, what would be your response and the response of the Buddhist community? And without any hesitation, I said, sir, if someone flushed a Buddhist book down my toilet, I would call a plumber. Because I would have to use that toilet afterwards, and you've got to be practical. So the first thing I'd do was call a plumber, but I would not. And I mentioned to him, that was a joke part of it. I can't resist a joke whenever I've got the opportunity. The most important part, I said, I would not allow them to flush Buddhism down the toilet. And then I made this wonderful distinction between the container and the contents. The book is a container. It contains Buddhism, or it contains Islamic teachings, or it contains Christian teachings. But it is not the religion. It's not Buddhism, a book. So I said, you can flush a book down the toilet, but I'm not going to allow you to flush Buddhism down the toilet. What do I mean by that? I'm not going to allow you to destroy our peace and our forgiveness and our compassion. I said, I will never allow anyone to flush forgiveness, compassion, peace, wisdom down any toilet. Because if I fight someone, if I get angry at them, then I'm flushing my understanding and forgiveness and kindness down the toilet. I would have lost. And I mentioned that you can kill as many monks and nuns as you wish. You can burn down all our temples. You can even smash up the Buddha statues like the Taliban did in Bamiyan. But we will never allow you to destroy our peace, our kindness, our forgiveness, our wisdom. And I was very proud, as many of you know, when the Taliban in Afghanistan did destroy those beautiful, huge Bamiyan Buddha statues, built I don't know how many centuries ago. When they blew them to bits, the response of the Buddhist community, it wasn't even to sort of get angry at the Taliban. It was to work harder to build more Buddha statues. Instead of getting angry and getting upset, let's not allow anybody to destroy what Buddhism really is. It's not in a book, it's not in a temple, it's not in a statue, it's not in a monk or a nun. It's in the teachings. The teachings of learning how to overcome these terrible urges in human beings to oppress and kill others, to get angry at others. We know that we can't get our own way sometimes, that things go wrong, that things don't go the way they should. I understand that, and I realize that's life, that's Dhamma. And I can be at peace with that. I don't get angry at it. I don't get upset at it. I don't shout at people when it doesn't go my way anymore. I don't get frustrated and angry. And you see what happens to people who do get angry. Not only do they wreck any relationship with other people, and they go destroying things because they don't understand that these are containers, this is the contents. Destroy the containers. No, we don't want you to, but if you have to, fine. But the contents are the most important thing. Buddha statue? We can make other Buddha statues. We can't make more people that easy, or more peace or forgiveness, because once there's an argument, once there's a war, it takes generations to solve the psychological wounds, let alone the material destruction of a war. You have a partnership, it takes such a long time to build up. Yeah, this beautiful peace and trust to one another. And you can sacrifice that relationship so easy, just on two stupid words, they say. Or because your partner doesn't do the things you want them to do, or they misbehave or whatever. You can't control your partner. The partner is the container of this relationship. It's the relationship which is most important. The peace, the kindness, and I keep on saying this, the forgiveness, the compassion. The ability to let go and to realize that what's the most important thing is not the things, but this spirituality inside of being at peace, being kind, forgiving and growing. So that's what I learned by building that building in a way I didn't think was proper. I still don't think we could have done much better with all the money we spent on that, but personally, that was such a growing experience for me. To do something I didn't like to do for the sake of doing something I don't like and giving it all my effort and kindness and care, all my energy. I put everything I had into that building. Just like if you want a relationship, you have to put everything in to doing things together, even if you don't agree. And if somebody wants to help you, as I often said, the old days used to be these Boy Scouts. These Boy Scouts who would help the old ladies across the street. And in those days I used to give advice to old ladies. If a Boy Scout comes up to you and says, I want to help you across the street, madam, please let him help you, even if you don't want to go. And many old ladies don't want to cross the street, but you give the opportunity, please help. Because the most important thing is not being on the right side of the street. It's actually having the opportunity for people to show their kindness, to show their compassion, to show their care. the things aren't important. It's the care is more important. So we've got like monks and nuns, and sometimes the last couple of days, you know, people are giving me New Year presents. Now what do you give a monk for a New Year present? Please don't offer a comb or a hairbrush. Sometimes people think, you know, Ajahn Brahm likes a joke, so give him a hairbrush. But actually other people have thought of that joke beforehand, so to give them away. But we still accept those things. We accept so much chocolate, even though there's no way that a monk could ever eat so much chocolate. But we accept that. Why? Because it's not the thing which is important. It's a kindness and a sharing. That's more. The gift itself is a container. It's what's inside it is important. I don't mean the filling inside the chocolate. I mean, it's the, you know, what they say, just the intention, the kindness, the sharing. That is the most important thing for me. And I know I can't. Sometimes you try and do that. You say, look, don't give so much chocolate. You know, I'm putting on weight. Don't give so much towels. You know, because sometimes, especially the Sri Lankan community, whenever they give a dana, they always put towels, you know, in the brown paper. How many towels does a monk need? I only shower once or twice a day. Or sometimes Thai people offer robes. And we have whole, store cupboards full of robes. This monk is a store monk, and you know, he will tell you just how much robes and stuff we sometimes get. But even though you try and say, don't give so much robes and stuff, give other things which are more useful, still, no. We can't control it. So say, okay, give a robe, give chocolate, give towels. Why? Because it's not the towel which we need. It's the kindness and the opportunity for people to share. That's what is important. So the same in your relationship or even in your office or whatever else you're doing in your life. Don't look at things and try just to get the right thing. This is not about materialism. It's about sort of something much deeper than that. It's not about getting the best haul. It's getting the best heart. So when I learn about that, you realize that all these containers, when you mistake the container for the contents, that's where you get problems. The marriage, that's a container. It's what you put into that container of a marriage which is important. Being a monk, a Theravada monk, wearing a robe. This is not important, it's like how you use that container, what's actually inside it. You know, the ability of a monk to serve, to be humble, to be peaceful, to have few possessions, and that's really important. It's what this container of a monk or a nun actually is. And so sometimes I ask people, I remember when we first came over to Australia about over 26 years ago now, I remember asking a Catholic priest I got to know here, I said, is it right, are you happy that we call ourselves monks or nuns? Because that is like a Christian word. And he said, well, look, I've looked how you behave. You know, you are simple. You know, you just have few possessions. You know, you're serving and being kind. You have surrendered a lot. He said, we would recognize you as monks or nuns. And that was really important to me because it was why he said, yes, you are a monk or a nun. Not because the robes or the bald head, which they didn't recognize, but because what was inside the robes, what was inside underneath the bald head, it was the simplicity, compassion and kindness which were important. So this is actually what a monk actually is. And many people, like Australians, have never seen some Buddhist monks or nuns. This is actually what you expect out of us. And if you see a monk with like expensive handphone or with like carrying their laptop and with a Rolex watch on the, you think, that's not a monk. Why is that? Because it doesn't fit, you know, what a monk should be. It's not just the Rolex, it's not just the you know, sometimes people said, Ajahn Brahm, you know, you're becoming quite a celebrity monk now. Isn't it time you had a, like a lame robe? You know, like people have on TV, which sort of glitters. They're only joking, of course. No, this is not to signify what a monk actually is. You've got to be simple and restrained and calm and peaceful and have few things and have few attachments. That's really what people expect of these things. The container is not as important as the contents. And the contents sometimes show you what the container is. The contents actually make the container sometimes, but the contents are the most important thing. So which is why that we shouldn't really argue, maybe with other religions or with people who we disagree with. Now there's a great saying of the Buddha, and it's a very interesting saying, because when he would be in conflict sometimes, people would accuse him of things he would never do or argue with him, and they never actually argued with him. He said, "I never argue with the world argues with me." There's a very interesting saying there, which, what do we actually mean by that? We mean that there is conflict, there is argument, there is disagreements. People want to do things a different way. You can't control the world and make it just your way. The world argues. The dogs bark. The politicians are stupid. Many of them are very good though as well. So there's things which go wrong, but we don't argue with that reality. We understand that in any relationship there will be times of great conflict. We understand that in life our body will give out and we'll become very sick. The nature argues with our body, but our mind understands and accepts this and makes peace with it. And understands we won't always get our own way. We won't have the aircraft leaving on time. We won't always have the seat we want in the aircraft. And we won't always sort of get people turning up on time. They will be delayed. They will not do the things we want. But now I understand that. That is life, so I don't argue with that. You don't expect everybody to do what they should do. A long time ago, when you first became abbot of Bodhinyana Monastery, I wanted all my monks to be perfect monks. And of course that was a lot of suffering. Doesn't matter how sneaky I was, doesn't matter how hard you worked, doesn't matter all the great talks you gave, the monks were just the monks. Same as when I teach meditation retreats. I really want all the people on the retreats to get jhana and become enlightened. And I work so hard, I give so many talks and so many interviews, and what happens? It's not my fault. So why should I get upset? So I realize I can't control anybody. And I can't control my body. And more importantly, I can't control life. So instead of fighting and fighting and fighting, instead of worrying about the containers, I just work on the contents. Instead of fighting, you learn how to make peace with things. Put all the effort you can into it, but letting go of having to succeed. Letting go of having to get results. Letting go of having to sort of get something substantial you can be proud of. And not substantial, but I go for the insubstantial now. If I teach a retreat and everybody just sleeps all day and talks when they're supposed to be quiet and sneaks in biscuits in the evening when they're only supposed to be eating in the morning, when they do things they're not supposed to do, do I get angry? Say no, because I don't look for success in achievements. I look for success in the process. I've done the best I could. I've given. And that's my success. So you don't try and get results. You just try to give. And that was what I understood in something basic in the spiritual path. You don't judge spirituality, peace and holiness by its results. It's always the path, the process. Which is why that somebody just told me this afternoon on one of the recent retreats, one of the best pieces of advice which I'd given them for their meditation, which really got them past a blockage, was when I said that in meditation you're not trying to achieve anything or get the nice lights or enlightenment experiences. then in meditation you're just giving your time, your mindfulness, the energy, just to this half an hour of sitting. And you're giving, expecting nothing back in return. It's just pure giving. It's not to get something, it's just for the spiritual beauty of just giving something, expecting nothing back in return. And that's something which was taught to me a long time ago by Ajahn Chah, because you'd see people giving donations to his monastery and they wouldn't even get a receipt. I've seen other temples and other churches and other institutions. If you give a donation, you get your name listed on the wall, or you get it printed in the newsletter. Or even if you give a huge donation, you can name the hall after you. This is Jenny's Hall. That's Jenny, by the way, in front of me. But if that's what you think you need to do, to give a big donation so that your name is put on the hall, in Buddhism we do not call that generosity. We don't call that giving. We call that buying advertising rights. You're advertising yourself, Jenny's Hall. That's not giving. So, if you ever give a donation here and you expect something back in return, that's not really generosity. It's the same if you give your mindfulness and compassion to this moment and you expect something back in return. That's not generosity. That's not the spiritual path. You've missed something. Which is why it often doesn't work. Sometimes people try and meditate and after half an hour, I'm not enlightened yet, it doesn't work. Now that's not an exaggeration. I've got to get some peaceful, I've got to get something out of this. You go on a 9-day retreat and you get nothing and you ask for your money back. Now what sort of attitude is that? What happens if you want to be successful in the spiritual path, not only the spiritual path but in life, is to be able to give, expecting nothing back in return. Because the process of giving, being kind, being compassionate, is good in and of itself. It's the same when you forgive somebody, someone who's hurt you, who's mistreated you, who's abused you. And if you forgive them and expect them to change, then you're missing out on the power of forgiveness. You're not forgiving somebody to get something. You're forgiving them just for the beauty of forgiveness, for its sheer inspirational spirituality, just for the sake of doing it. Same as you see people giving, even though you don't need the hairbrush or the comb. They give it just for the inspiration of giving, not expecting anything back in return. Now if you understand that, you understand why the process, what's contained in the container of whatever you do, is by far the most important. Outcomes you can't control. You might meditate, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. You give a donation to a charity, sometimes it reaches there, sometimes it doesn't. You know, you start off a relationship, you give everything you've got, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. You can't control the outcomes. All you can do is controlling the process by giving, expecting nothing at all back in return. The process is the most important thing. So when one understands this, you understand where a religion can lose it, where a church can lose it, when we just see the bigness of the church rather than the beauty of the people. We see the outcome of becoming rich, wealthy and powerful, famous, as an end in itself, rather than that's just side effects. What's most important is the process and the beauty of giving, forgiving, being compassionate. So next time you forgive someone, if you're forgiving someone, expecting them to change or be different, you're missing out the power. Forgiveness is there because that's going to raise you and everything up to this beautiful higher level. If you want an outcome, then you're demeaning the beauty of forgiveness. So any time of kindness, compassion, meditation, donation, whatever you do, when you have outcomes, it spoils everything. When you just have, what I'm doing now is just worth doing. I'm building that hall because it's worth building that hall. How it turns out, who cares? And it's a good enough hall, you've been there. It's a good enough husband, a good enough wife, a good enough partner. It's a good enough kid. It's a good enough body you've got. Come on. Don't sort of, you know, want more than is good enough. And with that degree, sometimes when I talk like this, people say, Ajahn Brahm, you're just telling us not to try, not to aspire, not to actually to do anything. I said, no, I'm telling you to put all your effort and aspirations in not to getting things, into getting beautiful hearts. And the goal of life, you know, what puts your effort, aspiration, what gives meaning to your life, is not all the stuff which you possess outside, but what you've built inside. What's the point of having a big mansion when you've got an unhappy heart? What's the point of having been CEO of a company? You know, you've made it on the Forbes 500 list when you sort of have to see a counselor every weekend just to get through your emotional blockages or have to take sleeping tablets to go to sleep at night. So the success in life, what we should be aiming for, what the goals are, is the spiritual, to perfect the process of kindness, peace, compassion, awareness, to make that good, expecting nothing else back in return. That is the goal. Peace, freedom, kindness, beauty. Obviously, wisdom as well. And I did say I was going to try and fit this story in here somewhere. How we develop wisdom, because wisdom is also about cooperation as well. If ever there is a problem in your life, I said this again to someone earlier, please never think it's your problem. Please never think it's their problem. I've often said it's always our problem. We're in it together, and part of the beauty of the process is being able to share with people. We're going to work this out together. And even if it works out and comes to a good conclusion, wonderful, but that's not so important. The most important thing is we work together. Not that it's going to solve all our problems, but the real problem is that we don't work together. That's the problem. So if we learn how to work together, then we have this beautiful spiritual life. We don't feel so alone, and actually we're coming closer to the reality that we are all in this boat together. But this particular story, here's the story of a mouse. This was given to me in Penang, so every time I go overseas, don't think, oh, Ajahn Brahm's gone, he should stay home more often, because I get more material when I go overseas. Once there was a mouse living in a farmhouse, and he was a happy little mouse, you know, reasonably well fed, because it's good to have a mouse in your house, because then you don't need vacuum cleaner, so the mouse can pick up all the bits and pieces. As long as the well-trained mouse, so it poos in the right place. But anyway, the farmer never liked the mouse. So one day the mouse was looking through a crack in the wall, and he saw the farmer unwrap a package. And when he saw what was inside the package, the mouse was terrified. The farmer had brought a mouse trap. And he was so upset, he went to see his friend, the chicken. Farmer's bought a mouse trap. Farmer's bought a mouse trap. This is terrible. This is disastrous. And the chicken said, not my problem. Nothing to do with me. So it's your problem, mouse. You know, nick off. And so the mouse got no sympathy from the chicken. So he went to see his other friend, Mr. Pig. Mr. Pig, Mr. Pig, farmer's brought a mouse trap. This is terrible news. I don't know if I'm going to sleep tonight. I'm in danger. Mr. Pig said, nothing to do with me. Your problem, a mousetrap. You can't catch a pig in a mousetrap. Just bad luck. Off you go. So he's really upset with his friend, Mr. Pig. So he went to see Mrs. Cow. Mrs. Cow, Mrs. Cow, please help. Farmer's brought a mousetrap. And I'm so afraid and paranoid now. You know, sometimes you're running around, you don't know what you're running on. I could get in that mousetrap and be killed. And Mrs. Cow said, well, it must be your karma from a past life, but nothing to do with me. And he never got any sympathy from any of those animals. And so he went back terrified. And that night, a snake came into the farmhouse and caught its tail in the mousetrap. And when the farmer's wife came to see if she caught the mouse, the snake bit the farmer's wife. So the farmer's wife got very sick. And because she was very sick, the farmer thought, what's a good thing for sickness? Chicken soup. So you got it. They got the chicken, chopped off its head, and boiled it to get some soup for the wife. Chicken lost its life. And of course, you know, she never got better. When she died, before she died, all her relations started coming to visit to make sure she was okay. They had friends and relations visiting the house, and a poor farmer, he didn't know what to feed them. So he got the pig and slaughtered the pig and gave them sausages and bacon. So the pig lost its life too. And doesn't matter just how much chicken soup they gave the wife, doesn't matter all the people visiting and farmers feeding the people, the poor lady died. And because she died, you all know how expensive funerals are. The farmer had to kill the cow and sell the meat to pay for the funeral. So in the end, chicken died, pig lost its life, cow got slaughtered because of the mouse trap. So it wasn't just the mouse's problem, it was everybody's problem. Which is the meaning of that story. Because sometimes we think, oh, it's not going to affect me. No, nothing to do with me, it's somebody else's problem. And the story says, no, it could be your problem too. So that's why we should always help each other, even though we think it's not going to affect us. Whether it's global warming, and I think, actually, our monasteries, Gijiganup, Dhammasar Monastery on top of a hill, Serpentine on top of a hill, even this place is actually quite high up, which is why we get good views. Global warming, rise of sea levels, Serpentine's going to be a beach monastery. I'm not worried. Nothing to do with me. You may think financial crisis. No, I've got enough money and investments. Nothing to do with me. Swine flu. I'm healthy. I'm okay. Nothing to do with me. Remember the story of the mouse, the pig, or the chicken, the pig and the cow. They never thought getting a mousetrap was anything to do with them, but it cost them their life. So that's why we are compassionate and wise, because we are all in this together. And what happens in Tuvalu affects the monks on top of the mountain in Serpentine. Sure, we don't see the water, but we see the tears. Yeah, sure, it doesn't destroy our homes, but it destroys our peace when there's someone else who really needs some help. So understanding this, part of this process, part of the reason we're doing here, is actually not to build things or make things. It's not about sort of what we get. It's about the process of our lives, of sharing, of being kind. Yeah, the outcome. Mousetrap's not going to help me. Going to hurt me. I'm a cow. I'm too big to get hurt by the mousetrap. But the wise cow thinks, no, we're in this together. The outcomes are not important. If a friend comes and asks for your help, it's a kindness, a compassion in the moment, the wanting to help and wanting to be here. That's the most important thing. So understanding what I've been saying today, just again, off the top of my head, because I actually thought that the questions were going to be the ones which were going to win this evening. So even I was wrong. But never mind, I can't control these things. So instead, you work with whatever you can do. You don't try and control this life. If can control this life, you get frustrated, you get angry. Oh, I never said what happens after you get angry. I've noticed this because I've been counseling people a long time and seeing people a long time. I know the way my mind works. When you try and control things, sooner or later you get frustrated. Then you get angry and have arguments. And after the argument, after the anger, you get depressed. Your partner leaves you, or you leave your partner. After the anger, you realize you just can't carry on. You lose all your energy, all your hope. Because anger is negative karma. It drains your energy. It drains your joy. So usually, after anger, comes depression. This is only a theory from a monk who knows the nature of the mind. But really, I think one of the reasons why there's an epidemic of depression in our modern world is because we always believe too strongly we're in control of things. The control freak nature has been developed in us, encouraged in us too much. As individuals, we always think we're in control of our destiny. I'm a free woman, I'm a free man. I can do whatever I want, which means I'm in control. And the reality is, we're not that much in control. And because of the illusion of control, we go through this frustration. How many young people get really frustrated? How many get angry? And you know why so many people get depressed? Because I can see a link, a path from those controlling, wanting things to work your way, frustration, anger, and finally depression. When you just lose all your energy, give up, lose hope. There is a middle way between that. And that middle way is caring for the process rather than the outcomes. Putting your energy into being kind, compassionate, good, and not where it's going to lead. Building the hall was not important. Building your heart was. That was my outcome, and that's what I learnt. So, that's the talk this evening. Processes, not outcomes. Building the heart rather than the horse. Now, comes the questions, because now we always have questions at the end of the talk.
Yes, Arjun.
Very good.
You started the talk with about harmony.
Yeah?
And I've been confused for the last couple of months since the beginning of the talk.
Ah.
And you've given a couple of talks over the years.
Yeah.
Harmony, and especially between the monks.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other one or two go along with it.
Yeah.
Can you explain to us a little about this in Thailand or whatever?
Okay. Remember that it's true that for the sake of harmony, this is actually in the units of government in monasteries. So the way the Buddha actually set up Buddhism was very wise. He was basing this on a democratic model. Many people thought that democracy started in Greece, but there's very strong arguments of saying it was in India even before Greece. Certainly in the time of the Buddha, 26 centuries ago, there were very well-established democratic systems. And the Buddha took that democratic system, and that's how he established the governance of the monks and the nuns. But in that democracy, there is also the devolving authority. And the way the Buddha devolved authority, he said every monastery would be independent. And it wouldn't have a head or a hierarchy. And you may remember one of the most amazing, powerful statements of the Buddha before he died, which had a huge effect on the spread and the strength of Buddhism. When people asked him, "Oh, you're obviously the head, the boss. When you die, can you appoint a successor? Who will be in charge of Buddhism once you pass away?" And the Buddha said, "After me, there will be no successor. Let the Dharma, the teachings, and the Vinaya, the training rules for monks, let them be your boss and your teacher." So that was a powerful statement. There was that, because of that, there was no possibility of having a pope, an archbishop, or anyone in total control. Now, the rules of governments, the constitution of the monasteries, that was what governed us. And that established autonomy between each monastery. So even now, our monastery in Serpentine, the monks look after that. And we don't look after the Bhikkhuni monastery at all. They look after that. And they're total separate entities, but both of us have to live within, you know, the rules set out by the Buddha. And one of those rules is within a monastery, within a community, there we have to live totally in harmony. There, that's where the decision-making happens. So we decide what we're going to do, and if one monk disagrees in Bodhinyana monastery, we can't do anything. Same as in Dharamsala, there's only four bhikkhunis there, but if one of them disagrees, no, we're not going to do this, then they can't do anything. So that's where the harmony lies, in the autonomous units called monasteries. However, sometimes that this was historical in the establishment of the Thai country, the Thai state, there was autonomy about 200 years ago. Every monastery was independent, run its own affairs. But then when they started to establish what's now the Thai state, they started to have power from Bangkok and have that as the authority, the central power. Beforehand, Thailand was many independent little states. No, it was pretty much independent states, even though it was called Thailand. People having huge autonomy. And they imposed that also on the monastic system as well. But when we come to Australia, it doesn't seem right to most people that sort of a group of monks in Thailand can actually impose their will on a group of monks sort of in another country. It's against the sense of democracy, and I think that's where one of the problems is coming from. You know, where the idea of like a democratic freedom to choose your own way and to make decisions within the Vinaya is conflicting with a hierarchical power system which has been developed over the last 150 years. So that's one of the problems there. That sort of makes sense without answering the question, sort of?
Well, the problem I still have is, I guess, with Thailand itself.
Yeah.
That they are not agreeing between them.
Yeah.
Back on side of it, but they're not agreeing between them. Therefore, where does this...
Yeah. Okay, where they're agreeing. It's just each monastery should actually be within itself to have that autonomy. And that is always what I understood, you know, from the early days as a monk. And what that actually means, like, every tree which grows in a forest has autonomy. You know, it's not told by the other trees how to grow. It's got its, you know, seeds, its DNA, its program within it. And therefore it grows. If it's got the good instructions, does the right thing, it grows into a beautiful tree. If it's in the right place, it flourishes. And in the past, that has been the strength of Buddhism. Because if you've got a good monastery, a good teaching, it actually grows and develops. If it's a bad teaching, you don't need to control it. A bad teacher, bad soil, it just withers and dies, just like trees growing in the wrong place. And because of that, that natural freedom of growth, it means Buddhism has been able to adapt from place to place, which is why we have Tibetan Buddhism, why we have Zen Buddhism, we have Korean Buddhism, Japanese Buddhism, we have got Thai Buddhism, Australian Buddhism as well. And it has had the ability to adapt Sri Lankan Buddhism to time and place because of this autonomy. However, that sometimes when there is a hierarchical system, you know, obviously what happens, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. When you do put some people in power, the power itself corrupts good monks. I remember this story of this from Mahayana Buddhism, very lovely story about these two hermits. They were living, these were monks, and they were living up on the mountain. They had, you know, the top hermit, just because he lived on the very top of the mountain, and the one which lived halfway down. You know, because they were both hermits, they didn't want to live next to each other. They're both really, really good monks. And it's very wise and very compassionate that when the emperor of China was having problems, you know, in his country, he decided to go and visit those hermits. So the emperor, he went up to the top hermit, first of all. And he said, look, you know, I've got great respect for you. You're so compassionate. You're so wise. And I'm having so much trouble with my ministers. They're just in it for their own power and wealth. I would like to appoint you as my chief minister. Now, because the monk had compassion and power, wasn't interested in worldly things. So he didn't get into all those problems which people in power get into. And this monk, this hermit, never even answered. He just went to the river, the stream which ran past his hermitage, and washed out his ears. And of course the emperor got the message and just bowed to him and left. And then when he went to the second monk living halfway down the mountain, before he can even ask the second hermit, the top hermit's attendant came running down, and told the lower hermit, don't drink anything from the water, from the stream. There's dirt in the water. And of course, when that the emperor heard that, he realized he had no chance with the second hermit also. He also left the hermits to be hermits. Because the two hermits realized that power, you know, inviting them to power is like putting dirt and muck in your ear. So you had to wash it out in the stream. But to tell the lower hermit the stream's being polluted. So I like that little sort of story because you have to be careful. You don't get yourselves into positions of power. And for those of you who think that Ajahn Brahma is a spiritual dictator of the Buddhist Society of West Australia, that some of you have served on committees, there's one reason we have a committee, the reason why we have, you know, like a constitution for checks and balances. So even the monks, the nuns, we don't have that much power. Our power is just to guide, to inspire. But you as members have all the power. So that's how we stop the problem with power. And sometimes I think it's the problem with power and control. That's one of the reasons of that controversy. Does that sort of make sense? Okay, you're asking the question, what sort of monks are those? And their thing is about harmony, but they're not actually doing that. I think that some of the monks think that they need to do this to create harmony. So in other words, this is the thing, they've got to be tough, they've got to be hard, they've got to speak badly, because they think that thereby they will solve the problem of bringing harmony back to Buddhism or whatever. Now that's what I was talking about this evening. When we do things because we think it's going to, you know, create a good end result, when the end justifies the means, then we always get into big trouble. So really, how I've been taught and how I practice is the means is important, not the end. You make good karma, you know good things are going to happen in the end. So whatever the outcome is, you always make sure you speak kindly, you speak truthfully, you keep your rules and your precepts. So it doesn't matter what other people say about you. For me, it's the precepts, the kindness. And I always think that protects me. When I came back from overseas, I told people another story. But this is a story many of you will remember from your childhood. Not a Buddhist story. It's the story of the three little pigs and the big bad wolf. And this is actually a good Buddhist story, and it's very apt for the situation which, you know, I particularly am in right now. Once there was the three little piggies, and the first piggy, because there was a big bad wolf around, built a house of straw. And the big bad wolf came and he huffed and he puffed and he blew the house down and ate the little piggy. The second little piggy built a house of wood. And that was a bit stronger, but still it was a big bad wolf. And he came and he huffed and he puffed and he huffed and he puffed and he blew the house down and ate the piggy. And the third piggy built a house of bricks. And the big bad wolf came, he huffed and he puffed and he puffed and he huffed and he huffed and he puffed until he got such a sore throat he gave up. And that little piggy survived. And so what do we mean by that? As long as you keep your precepts and do good work and have strong karma, means you've got the house of bricks. And the big bad wolf, or the big bad monks, they can huff and they can puff and they can puff and they huff and they huff and they puff, they never blow the house down. So you understand, if ever your people are getting angry at you, upset at you, challenging you, whatever you're doing, if you've got like a house of bricks, the big bad enemies, they can huff and puff and huff and puff, and they'll never blow your house down. Why? Because you have that inner strength. The process which has built the house of bricks means it's going to be safe. So you know, our job is to make sure we always say the right things, with kindness, with truthfulness, with honesty. And we never respond to anger with more anger. We never respond to untruth with our own untruth. We never respond to disharmony with more disharmony. We always want to give forgiveness, to seek reconciliation and have harmony. So that's, you know, our house of bricks. And that will never be blown apart. So that's, you know, my guiding principle for the next few weeks. To make sure, remember the story of the big bad wolf and the three little pigs. Any other questions? Who's coming up? Yes, Eddie.
Can I share something on the depression you said just
now? Okay, please do, yeah.
You don't need medication for depression, okay? It's all in the Buddha's teaching.
Yeah. Okay.
Depression comes from yourself, maybe through anger.
Okay.
Prolonged anger causes, as you say, causes depression, anxiety, and blah, blah, all these things. It's all from your mind.
Okay. Very good. Okay. He was saying that he agrees with me that from anger you get depression. But be careful by saying it's all in the Buddha's teachings, because I was told, I think, was it Tom Cruise was saying you don't need any medication because Scientology tells you it's all unnecessary. So when he says it's all in the Buddha's teachings, I'm a bit careful of that. Because I think one psychiatrist told me there is a condition which is extreme depression. I think, I forget what it is. What? Manic depression, whatever it is an extreme form of depression, which if you try to meditate or listen to the Dharma, you won't be able to do it. It's just gone too far. And in that case, yes, you do need medication. Medication to get you to a state where, you know, maybe some Buddhist teachings can kick in. It's the same as the sense of other physical problems. If you have a broken leg, you can't just meditate, be kind, 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 be compassionate. Please go and see a doctor, call an ambulance. But I get your point, though. Depends on the effort you do. Depends on the effort and the trying. But to be practical, some people just don't have the means to get the effort up. They don't have the ability to try. They've gone so deep that they can't actually get out by themselves. When you go too deep in the well, you can't climb out. You need a rope or a ladder or someone to come and rescue you. And sometimes, that's why I always want to make sure of being a middle way as a Buddhist, and don't be extreme in thinking that meditation will solve everything in the whole world. That, you know, sometimes we need to have a practical as well, have a moderate sort of way of understanding these teachings. Otherwise, you can be an extremist Buddhist. That makes sort of oxymoron. It means you're not really a Buddhist. But, you know, if there is something which can help, help. I remember this monk I had, he got on a mosquito bite, he scratched it, and this arm became infected, ballooned up. And we're trying all these herbal medicines and poultices and stuff on it and urinating on it. And all sorts of weird stuff. And then one day, one person said, why not try penicillin? And it healed up in a couple of hours. So I always remember that story, because we're all into natural therapies and no chemicals and stuff. But it works. So sometimes it's good to take even traditional chemical medicines as well, if it works. Don't rely on it, no. Don't think that's the only way. I agree with you there. And all these teachings, they're really, really good. So, you know, you really get into this meditation, this kindness, and training your mind as well. That is really, really powerful, but sometimes you do need a bit of help. Even I need chemical help to give talks, cups of tea. That's pretty natural, though. Okay, any last question before we finish off this? Okay, last question, yes? Controlling and training the mind. Now what we're saying here, controlling is dependent upon outcomes. Training is dependent upon process. And you're a school teacher, and you know how awful it is as a teacher to have your work judged on how many, say, TE successes you get, you know, or scores, you know, on sort of mathematics or English or whatever. And that just misses the point of the whole point of teaching. Say you've got a kid in front of you and just giving them the support to grow, to learn, to know how to learn. And when you have all these, you know, exams, you know, when you're examined as a teacher, you know that how that really restricts, you know, your ability to teach. Because teach isn't measured by the outcomes, it's measured by the process. So for you to strive as a teacher, if you were free from all the bureaucracy and all the stuff which is imposed upon you by the governments and driven by, you know, the stuff which is written in newspapers about education going down, kids can't spell, kids can't add up and all that sort of rubbish, that because it's driven by that agenda, it's stopping you teaching. And you know that teaching is a process. That's the problem.
So we've got a system that's saying, you know, the outcome, you are judged on the outcomes.
You are judged on the outcomes, and that's the system. And the reason I brought that up is because I know you're a teacher, and I know that, you know, you just don't like that. No teacher does. And it's an example of what we mean, the difference of controlling and training. So one is outcome-driven, the other one is a process. Process is the best outcome, in one sense. How you do it. Now, being with a kid, whether he gets the top mark or the bottom mark, is that the experience of being educated. The marks will come later on. Now, the success will come later on. But it's not measured by, you know, how many marks you get in the examination. That was the essence of Daniel Goleman's book, Emotional Intelligence. You know, when he found out the great little piece of research. All these people who got first, double first, you know, at university from Ivy League colleges, he would think, surely these are geniuses, they'll do really well in life. And he tracked them further down the life stream and found that they were never as successful as the people who just came somewhere in the middle in university. And he wanted to find out, how can I predict at university, you know, who's going to be successful in life? Obviously, you know, getting the sort of the Beasley Medal or getting the sort of the scholarships overseas and getting all the first at university with honours, that did not predict success. So, you know, he did his research and found out it was this thing which he coined the emotional intelligence. That was a predictor of success in life. What is emotional intelligence? The processes of networking, being kind, being able to listen, how it's done, gave rise to success. And that's exactly the same I learned from this HR manager. She was in Department of, not DFAT, it was Department of Fisheries, Trade and something else in UK. David Miliband was the head of that. He did such a good job, maybe because of this lady who was the HR manager, that he got promoted to be, was it Home Secretary or Foreign Secretary or something? But anyway, she was making this department, making it very clear to them that it's not about getting the agreement signed in Brussels, you know, which was their outcomes. You know, they wanted to get it passed by the European Union. He said, too many people have just got burnt out, all your great talent is leaving because you've been telling people you got to get this signed. And they've been working late, forgetting their families, getting upset and angry, because they were wholly driven by this one outcome. And they forgot about the process, how it was done. And she argued with David Miliband and convinced him. He said, that is not the way to run a government department. How it's done, the process is more important. Make sure your people are happy, content, motivated, driven, cared for, valued. And if you don't get the contract, fine. But people have really got some fulfillment. They've been valued. They've had rest when they need to get rest, which means they don't leave. Their motivation is still there. They really want to serve. Now, the contracts will be signed maybe the next time or the next time. But you're valuing your people, the process. Same with education. How many teachers leave? Good ones. Why? Because the process of teaching is not valued. And you're forced to get this result or that result. And that kills people. And that's what I was talking about this evening. Even in religion, you can kill religions if it's the process, wanting to have control, wanting to have this or that. It's how it's done is most important. That makes sense? I thought it would do, but if there's anyone in the education department here, they may be upset at me today.